Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Flesh and Blood and Bone podcast. I am filmmaker Kira Gardner, and this is my special effects makeup artist dad, Tony Gardner.
And I am Tony Gardner, dressed like I would never dress other than for my daughter, Kira Gardner.
We got my dad to wear a goth Christmas hat, a Santa hat. It's amazing. We love him for that and for doing this for me. Thank you.
Yes. And we're doing something different today, right?
Today's episode does not follow anything from your career. It's more of a generic Q&A between the two of us, mainly questions for my dad and special effects makeup and puppetry, maybe, if we dive down that route.
Is this from people writing in, or?
Yes. Our last episode, we asked you what you would like to see, and someone, I misinterpreted the tone on YouTube, but somebody commented, I'd like to hear what your dad wants to talk about. And I read it like, I want you to, like,
ask shut up.
Yeah, basically. but that was not the tone whatsoever. And they suggested something that wasn't tied down to any particular project. So shout out to that person who commented. Their username is Yoda's Scrotum. So shout out to Yoda's Scrotum. We appreciate the comment.
Yes.
Yes. So.
And somehow we're also Christmas themed.
Yes. This episode, we are wearing Santa hats because we personally are celebrating Christmas. But happy holidays to everybody this December, whether you're celebrating Hanukkah or Kwanzaa or Yule or whatever you and your family or loved ones or friends celebrate at home.
Or if you're just happy for the end of the year.
Yeah, I know I am. I'm very excited to get into 2025 and leave 2024 behind.
Well,
you know,
I think many people are for many reasons.
Yes.
And many people also aren't for many reasons.
Yeah. It was a year.
Yeah.
Yeah, that existed. I forgot to mention our guest here with us on the podcast today. If you're watching with us, we have Chucky behind us, and I did buy him an Elf on the Shelf costume. That's for, I think, a 3-month-old baby. And he's
in case you're dressing a Chucky at home.
Yes, yes. In case you want to dress. Yes. In case you want to dress your Chucky at home on Etsy, if you get a Elf on the Shelf baby costume, I would actually suggest a 2-month-old because it's a little bit big and I had to safety pin it. But yes, this is for our December theme, our little Elf on the Shelf, Chuck on a Hutch. I think was the meme I saw one time. So.
Oh, for real?
Yeah, it's Chuck on a Hutch, or I don't know.
I saw a Snoop on a stoop. I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah, that's pretty rad. So I have about 10 questions for my dad, some of which answers will probably be longer and some will be shorter. And my dad has just a few questions for me as well. We did not tell each other the questions in advance, so you'll be getting our honest reaction and feedback. Ready?
Yes.
Hopefully this is an easy one to start with. I don't know. Okay. He has anxiety already. First question.
Why are you so old?
What? No. Aging happens to literally everybody, and age is just a matter of mind.
It's a state of mind. I agree.
That's what I think.
Yep.
So first question I have is, what are the qualities of a good SFX makeup artist? What do you think makes someone a good SFX makeup artist?
Okay, well, part of that answer is in the question. Title. Or, yeah, makeup
effects. You have
effects
to do artist. Makeup effects.
It's just the artistry of it, being good at being an artist. But the flip side and the other half of it is really being a good communicator. And you have to get inside somebody's head and figure out what they want and build for them. You also have to be able to put your ego in check and not make it be about you, because you are an artist for hire. But being a good artist is key. Being able to listen, interpret what somebody is saying, and then articulate it verbally so you can have a dialogue to figure out what you want to do. And then being able to actually be responsible enough to execute on that in a timely fashion within a budget is just as important on the back end of it all.
That's true. You don't want somebody who's going to wreck your budget by needless spending or over complicated things.
It looks great, but now we can't film it because we don't have money for film.
Yeah, that'd be good.
It's bad.
To not do that. So would you put that above somebody who's more thinking that they need to like be refined in their paint theory, color theory? Or...
Yeah, I feel like the art end of it, I mean, it's just so wide open in this industry. You can, there are people that only punch hair and that's literally all they do. And they're paid really well to do it. And they can do it at home in front of soap operas while they're, you know, eating. And they totally hit their deadlines and do a great job. And other people need the structure of being in a shop and somebody sort of helping them focus on what they need to do. But you could be a painter, you could be a sculptor, you could be a three-dimensional designer, be a 3D artist that only works digitally. If you can do both and work in the physical medium, that's fantastic. Some people just paint. Being able to apply makeup is a really great skill, because if it doesn't glue down and look like part of the person, it doesn't work. And then I've seen prosthetics that are very basic in execution be turned into something amazing through the paint job on top of it. So knowing how to paint a makeup using grease paint or PAX paint or alcohol-based paint or whatever is involved, it's all really important. If you are painting a creature suit, like in a shop, and it needs to be painted with rubber cement, there's a whole skill set in mixing colors and working with that material as it sets up, basically, to make sure that you're able to blend colors and get what you want out of it.
Did you say painting with rubber cement?
Yeah, you're mixing like tints and colorants in with rubber cement.
How do you paint with
cement?
And
then thinning that, and then you can either brush paint it or you can airbrush it.
But it's cement.
It's glue.
Why is it called cement?
Rubber cement is a glue.
Oh, that's misleading.
You're cementing parts together.
Oh, I like
with
that.
This glue. That's how I interpret
that
it.
That should be the ad.
Yeah. Yeah, but rubber cement is, it's, you know, it's what you would glue stuff together in elementary school with has a really high solvent in it. All the little kids would get super high doing it, so the teachers would kind of like
put a lid on it.
Yeah, keep them away from that and go to the Elmer's glue.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize that special effects makeup isn't just being the person that's on set doing
the
makeup.
No, that's the final step of the whole process. I mean, also, too, the very beginning of production, once it's, you know, sculpted, there are people that make molds and only make molds, and people that only run silicone or skins or urethanes or foam latex. And then there's people that seam, patch, and then there's priming and painting with different materials based on what it is that you're painting. Then there's the hair, and then there's people that only make like eyeballs and teeth as well. And that's a full-time job for some people, and some people have spun it off into like side business.
To follow up with that, what would you say is maybe a job, like a specific job that you see here as someone based in Los Angeles that maybe this industry might need more of? Like, do you feel like there is a lack of specific like mold makers or hair punchers or anything like that?
I don't really feel like there's a lack of anybody right now, but I think the more diversified you are and the more you can do, the more opportunity there is for you to be on a project longer and get more involved and be able to show off what you can do at the same time. The more you're capable of, the more you can be used and utilized, and then the more work opportunity that you'll get from that. When I first came out here, I showed pictures of things that I was making just for myself. And I remember a person who owned a shop said, you need to pick one thing and do it well. You can't just sculpt it and mold it and paint it and hair it and do all that. You pick one so you can really stand out in that field and always be doing that. It's like, I don't think I could do just one thing on a personal level anyhow. But I mean, that's obviously what worked well for them.
That also seems to go across into filmmaking itself is, you know, my passion is directing, but I wouldn't be able to do that if I didn't, you know how to edit and could do this podcast or edit music videos I direct to save money in order to direct the music video because they're low budget.
Yeah. The more you know.
The more you know.
The smarter you can be in regards to what you're doing. And
speaking of makeup application, There are two types of prosthetics that exist, foam latex and silicone. Mm-hmm. What are the differences between the two, and what's the pros and cons of each prosthetic type?
Okay, the differences. Foam is lighter and holds its shape and is completely opaque, and you can sweat through it because it's a sponge. Silicone is... you can cast it however, whatever translucency you want. So you can make it like skin or even more translucent for, like, you know, weird waterlogged zombies or whatever you wanted to experiment with. Silicone is heavy. It blends into the skin. It photographs like skin. It takes makeup like skin. Someone described painting foam latex to me once, like you are painting a tabletop to look like skin, because it's an opaque thing and you're trying to make it look like it has depth and translucency, whereas silicone inherently has that. But if you're doing a big, heavy makeup on somebody, you want the translucency of silicone, but you don't want the weight of it. You might mix the two and do a foam understructure and then have the prosthetics glue down over top of that. A foam understructure to take up a lot of the mass, like in the neck or something like that. And they could do a foam latex prosthetic over that to represent the skin that gets blended in and all that. Silicone didn't exist like back when we did Hocus Pocus. So Doug Jones's makeup as the zombie, Billy Butcherson, was foam latex. When we did Hocus Pocus 2, silicone existed. And the big dilemma was, we can upgrade this makeup and make it look cooler and more real and translucent. But the truth is, it's the character so ingrained in culture at this point. If somebody's going to sit down and watch Hocus Pocus 1 and 2 back to back, the last thing you want to see is something changing appearance for no apparent reason. So when we did Hocus Pocus 2, we went with foam for a completely different reason than you normally would. It was so that it was true to the look of the original makeup 900 years ago. And the character looked true. So sometimes you're making a decision based on factors that have nothing to do with the ease of working with it or anything like that. Like all the bad grandpa stuff is silicone because we're trying not to add a lot to somebody and make them all wrinkly and leathery. But when we did Spike Jones as Gloria, the heavy version of the female character in the Jackass movies, we switched over to foam latex because we wanted her to be really big and have a really big bodysuit.
Oh.
And we didn't want Spike to feel encumbered. And then also, too, that's the sort of format where you're putting somebody in makeup and you're walking away from them for a while, and it has to be glued and solid and stay the way it needs to stay. And you can sweat in foam and it'll survive longer than a silicone.
How long do you think you could sweat in a silicone prosthetic?
Me, probably like no time at all. It would be ruined in zero time.
What?
But some people don't sweat. Like Karen Malkus, we'd put her in all those creature suits. She never sweat.
Whoa.
Yeah, I think she was actually an alien.
She's magical.
Yeah, something.
I like that. I wonder what Doug Jones's preference is. Probably foam? I don't know.
I don't know. It depends, you know, because you can glue the stuff down with different glues. Like we've done the Geico caveman in silicone, and then same thing, it was an artistic choice based on previous presentations of the character. We should go to foam because that's what people are used to seeing, but the silicone version looks more real to the naked eye.
I also for the life of me cannot figure out how to paint a foam latex prosthetic. I don't understand it.
A lot of colors and a lot of layering, and it's an opaque surface, so a lot comes down to how it's lit to make it believable. You know,
I see. This next question relates to both filmmaking and special effects. A lot of people, in order to save money, will DIY their own stuff. One of the most common things I feel that's made by people trying to save some money and are in the horror or fantasy genre is blood.
Oh.
What are some do's and don'ts of making your own blood? And do you have a favorite blood that you use?
I have a favorite. It's called The Blood by Gary Tunnicliffe. It smells like pancakes.
No so way.
It's got that going for it. It's got like maple syrup in it and it smells good. And so it's not like overwhelming people. And then it washes out of things really well. I think the biggest don't is don't forget to test and see how much pigment will come out of the blood that you're using and stay on a makeup or on clothes or in hair.
Or the wall.
Yeah, because it's like there's different brands and they'll be labeled, you know, does not stain. And that's not necessarily the case.
Liars.
It maybe doesn't stain sealed enamel or wood, but it stains
cement.
Yeah, or fabrics or whatever. So it's like testing all that stuff is really good. And food coloring stains. I mean, everything for the most part does. But Gary's blood, the blood, T-H-E, the blood, is fantastic. And nice. There's a lot of other ones that are really nice too that come in different colors and viscosities for pumping and stuff like that. But it really comes down to where you're shooting it and where it's going to spray. And if you have to redo it, do you have to like scrub somebody's skin and wash their hair and change your wardrobe and clean the wall behind them? Or is it something you just wipe down really easily and
right.
and cheat your way into the next shot? Because once you're shooting, as you know, time is money and time is finite.
Don't I know it?
Yeah.
The blood I very much like to work with is called Red Rum.
Yeah, that's a good one.
And for the most part, it comes out of pretty much everything, clothes and your skin and the wall. Although we did get a remnant of it on a cement wall in college. But, you know, it's really the wall's fault for having such large pores.
For being so porous.
Yes. Yeah, so corn syrup and red food coloring is a sure way probably to stain some shit.
Yeah, and then there's bloods that have been like variations on that where people put photo flow or soap or whatever in it so that it flows better. And some people put detergent into blood to make it wash out a little bit better. But a lot of times that doesn't make a difference. And then once you start putting chemicals in it, you have to be really careful on the skin too. So just be careful. You can Google all of it now and find out what's what.
For yourself.
Yeah.
But
it's pretty great.
But how often do you have an actual special effects makeup artist who has seen it all comment on what he thinks?
I have stained it all.
He has stained it all. He has killed a lot of people.
Yeah.
And things. And animals.
Yep.
Yep.
Such a great legacy I leave.
Yes. Yay, Dad. Do you want to ask a question before I ask a little bit more serious questions? Or how do you feel?
No, I want to ask a question.
Okay.
Based on your experience to date, if someone were interested in getting into filmmaking, would you recommend film school?
Ooh. You know what's interesting is I just watched a video of this director lady that popped up on my Instagram yesterday, and she was mad dissing on film school.
Really?
Yes.
Why?
She said that it's like a microcosm where you're regurgitating what's around you because you're coming from a smaller environment like high school and then in this environment where a lot of people are into film. But I don't think I necessarily agree with that because there are a lot of people who didn't know that they wanted to get into filmmaking, myself included. Like, I was touring nursing schools right before then. So I was actually exposed to a lot more than what I would have willingly watched and also what other people's tastes were that are much different from yours. And
I mean, once you got into film school?
Yeah, once I got into film school. And also when you're in college, you know, people are from all over the country or the world. So you're also getting exposed to people with much different backgrounds, cultural, religious, whatever. I would recommend it if you can afford it, but it's not necessary. The thing is like, if you didn't go to film school and you just went right in, like say for myself, if I just went to LA and PA'd, like I don't think I would have been able to turn out so many short films in such a short span of time and get such good feedback and like experience. If you PA, that's good because you're getting actual onset experience, but it might not be in the exact field you want to go into.
It's a more limited situation.
Because in order to work up in that department, you have to keep PAing, and then eventually you'll AD. But if you don't want to AD,
then what's PA?
A PA is a production assistant.
Okay, what's an AD?
An AD is an assistant director, and there are many assistant directors. There's first assistant director, second assistant director, second assistant director, and I think that's pretty much it. But I did PA a lot when I moved out from film school to LA, but I got just really good at taking breakfast orders and learning how to carry six cups at the same time, because everybody wants to order not just a water, but also an orange juice and a coffee for breakfast. So if you're listening to this, please, for the love of God, only order a coffee or water or just those two things in the morning, so that your breakfast PA does not have to bend over backwards trying to figure out how to make 12 cups of coffee at once. Observing, and the connections are probably maybe more, I don't want to say valid, but maybe more strong to people in your circle, right? You're getting to know other production assistants, people on set who could potentially give you jobs later. So that's good, because I would say, like, one of the side effects of going to film school in Tallahassee, since I went to film school at FSU, was I got really close with the community there, and I was really close to a bunch of consignment shops where I could borrow production design for free and return it, and developed relationships with homeowners. But then when I moved back to LA, it was like I had to start all over again. I didn't know where I could use stuff for free from, or know who had a house I could film at for free. So I think maybe taking that into consideration when you apply is like where you eventually want to be, because it takes time to build that rapport.
And you have to be doing it consistently in order to build that rapport too.
And I'm also an advocate for film school, because it was an environment where I feel like I was able to soak in more for me personally than on the job, because on the job is also very stressful, and maybe sometimes people make you cry in the production trailer in the morning, and then you're like, I don't even, why am I here, you know?
Right.
So that's that answer.
Okay.
Speaking of crying, my next question for you. We're going to get a little serial. We're going to get a little serious.
Okay.
So in your experience, you were working at Rick Baker's shop.
Uh-huh.
And then eventually opened your own SFX shop that we are sitting in now, called Alterian Inc. It must have been really scary from going to working for somebody to being your own boss. And are there benefits to opening your own studio as opposed to working for somebody else?
I think there's benefits to both sides of that. When you're working for somebody else, you have the opportunity to get involved in areas that you wouldn't normally do, because somebody needs an extra pair of hands or whatever, or minus a person in mold department, and here's how you do flashing, and you know, whatever the scenario is. So working in a shop is great. There's an environment that is supportive, and there's structure, and you're going into work doing a job and then going home every day, and you don't have to think about it until you get back there the next day. I mean, if you care about what you do, you're thinking about it anyhow, but you're not stuck on the nuts and bolts and what does this cost and everything else to the same degree that you would be if you were the shop owner. When I worked for other people, I learned a lot about what I did and didn't like in a shop by working for Stan Winston or Rick Baker or Greg Canham. And everybody has their pros and cons, like everybody does in real life. And it's like, what are the strengths of each one of these people? And what are their weaknesses? And how do they balance that out? And how do they make it work? And I like to like watch people. So it was like, it was a great learning environment to learn not just the craft of whatever we were doing, but also like just the way to work with people and to run a place. And I got to the point where I was coordinating the shop and organizing the schedules and stuff like that. And I was like, I really enjoy this, but I would never want the responsibility of doing this for myself.
That's hilarious.
And then, but at the same time, like, you know, I like within a year or two of starting to work for Rick in this instance, I was offered to do, you know, I got offered to do the half corpse for Return of the Living Dead. And it was just a couple weeks of work in the evenings while we were doing Cocoon.
Right.
And so I just pull that stuff out and work it at night because it had a very finite deadline. They were already shooting and came to me last minute to make this stuff. So I started doing little independent things on my own and stuff like that. It was like I would go to Bill Sturgeon, hey, can I hire you to make the joints for the fingers? And Scott Ressler, can you help me with this part? But I'd be like running the foam and making the molds and doing all the stuff, doing very poor facial mechanics and learning as I was going. But I was having these experiences where I was like sort of running my own little thing, whether it was just me or me with a couple other people. And they were just a couple weeks here or a month there. And it was kind of like moonlighting on my own stuff. So I started segueing right away. And then when The Blob came up in 1988, I interviewed just to do a couple effects that were going to be ancillary to the main effects because they had hired Greg Canham to do The Blob because he had worked with Chuck Russell, the director, on a bunch of other films, and they had a really good relationship. And then, you know, I was going in and interviewing with other people that I had worked with at Rick's, like Dave Miller and other folks, to do these three or four smaller effects. And then I was hired to do those few things. And I was like, great, that's just enough that I can handle. And then Greg had a conflict, couldn't do it, asked me to step in and take Greg. They asked me to take Greg's work. And then I would hire somebody else to do my stuff. And I'm like, well, really, all this stuff should artistically follow the same path and have the same cohesive look to it. So they should be in the same building that I'm in. So nothing goes off the rail now that this is tighter to the deadline. And then it was like, well, if that's the case, why don't we just hire them as part of our crew and just make our crew a little bit bigger?
So kind of just happened organically.
So I kind of fell into it. So it wasn't like but I really didn't want to do it as far as like being in charge and running it. And then I took the perspective of, this is a puzzle. How do you figure out how to make all these pieces fit, all these processes go together and work and hit this deadline on time? And it was like, that was sort of like the challenge and all that. And you have to step back away from the art side of it a little bit more, and you have to sort of steer the boat and steer the people and steer the calendar. And they put me in a building with Lyle Conway, who was doing the blob side of it, which was the organic blob creature. So we shared this big studio together. So there were resources there, and they put me in case, because I was 24.
Yeah,
I think. And they're like, well, if the kid chokes, you know, here's a seasoned adult who can take care of him. But I just sort of like blossomed and I hired all my friends that I'd worked with in different shops. And we had a really great time and were really creative. And I realized that I really liked running a shop. And then once that was over, that was the end of it. That building existed only because the production company had rented it for us. And when I came back after that, I was like, well, what do I want to do? Do I want to start my own place?
Mm-hmm.
Your mom and I had run the Blob Shop together.
Right.
She was the production coordinator for the makeup effects. And we realized we worked really well together and we could do it. So it's like, well, let's just go for it and go out on our own. And we did. And then we had some, you know, hits and misses along the way. People that said, hey, I can help you out. And they weren't very helpful, and some bad detours along the way. But ultimately, that way that we started out, where it was just Tony Gardner and Cindy Gardner, I always called it the art brain and the smart brain because I could do art. And if you talked to me about numbers too much, my eyes would probably roll back. But your mom, like, she's so smart and with it, and she's really good at like figuring out how to problem solve as well in a different way. It's just like it just worked really well, and we're still here
over 30 years later.
Yeah, and still going.
Still going. And
so that was a really long answer to that question about how it worked and what it's like, but it's going to be different for everybody. And you know, stepping out on your own is always scary, obviously, but it's also exciting. And if you can like harness the adrenaline, there's no harm in saying yes to stuff and just going for it. When we started, people, you know, Sam Raimi, have you done overlapping prosthetics before? I'd be like, yeah. but it was really kinda. I'd done very minimal stuff, and he's like, oh, good, because this Darkman character is a full head of prosthetics and blah blah blah. And it's like, dive in, find people to help you that in arenas that you don't know how to do stuff, and whether you're trading them dinner or you're hiring them as an employee or you're getting them a screen credit and or bartering or whatever.
Yes,
it's like, you know, make stuff happen, because nobody's gonna like sit you down and help make stuff happen for you. You have to go for it.
Yeah. Speaking of taking detours, I have recently, you know, experienced that some people can say they will do things and can do things and then absolutely cannot and have screwed you over.
Right.
So I have that question of, what was the one of the harder experiences or projects that you worked on, whether it was a person or the job itself, that made it really hard, and how did you get through it?
I think some of the jobs can be really hard on their own, but I think keeping in mind with every job that there is an end point to it, and it's not the rest of your life, but there is going to be an end point. I think that mindset makes a difference. But for me, being like the shy kid, the quiet artist, having to be the guy in charge and learning how to speak up for what I want and be able to articulate the direction we want to go with something and why, or what my preference is, any of that kind of stuff, was the most difficult area of it for me. And very specifically, when somebody wasn't performing and you had to fire them. It's just the worst, because you really want them to work out and you hired them for a reason. And then when it's not happening and it's not working, and it could be a multitude of reasons. It could be ego. It could be talent or lack of selling themselves as capable of doing something, but they can't. Or they end up on drugs and they just cannot give you what you need.
That is more of a, like, I know that you started in late 80s, but it's still a problem today. Like,
yeah.
People legit are sometimes on drugs. And not to make light of and of people who are addicted, but just, you never know, because you're dealing with human beings at the end of the day, yeah. And human beings are unpredictable.
Yeah, yeah. Interpersonal stuff, conflict is just hard, period. You know, and if it's somebody that, you know, you like part of them a lot and you don't want it to not work out, it just makes it harder when it's definitely and obviously not working out and you have to step in and have to stop it, because it's on you to make things work if you're the person in charge.
Yeah.
But trying to listen to everybody and hear them and hear why and what's happening, it's hard.
Yeah.
People and business are a weird mix, and then business and art is a weird mix. And business and art are two different languages. And
somehow you all got to speak the same one.
Yeah, and that's the challenge. And if you think of it as a challenge instead of a hassle, it's like, how do I rise to this challenge? I think that's what makes a difference, because attitude is everything. Did I answer the question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were you thinking of anything in particular?
Well, I was just coming from the experience of having gone through one of the hardest situations. Maybe I was just like, maybe I'll ask my dad a question for my own benefit. Mwahaha. But no, I just came out of probably one of the worst experiences of my entire career. And that's okay. But it's hard when, for instance, for me, I care a lot about a lot of things. I'm highly emotional. And I think as artists, that is kind of comes naturally if you're in the art realm. And when somebody or something has gone so drastically, chaotically wrong, and you've been personally hurt by either someone or something, it's really hard to be able to sort of let that go and not let it hinder your experience as a whole. So I was just curious if there was anything that helped you get through some times that I personally know people have been poo-poo.
It's easier to talk about than do, obviously, but just being able to separate the emotional aspect from the actual experience or issue that's going down.
Yeah.
It's really hard, especially when the emotional aspect, it feels like a personal thing because
yes,
it's your personal project, you know. But I think as artists, whatever you do, art is an expression of your persona. And I think that's hard. That's why it's hard for some people even to do art as work for hire, because they put their self into it. And then when you critique the work as not being correct for the scope of the project, the artist would take it as a personal assault, as opposed to it's not right for what the customer wants to do.
Yeah.
I mean, there's that layer all the way down to, this is the idea I came up with and you said it sucks and I hate you. and you have to be bigger than that.
Yeah, that's the thing. It all goes back to the language of artist and business, and it's hard to be able to do both.
Yeah, well, one person only cares about the numbers and what it's going to cost, and the other person doesn't care about your feelings, and then the other person doesn't care about either.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to be 100% on the same level communicating with you. I mean, the same word is interpreted differently by two people that you think would interpret it the same way. You could do a simple example, just being the color, what's the color blue?
The ocean, and you say the sky.
Or aquamarine, or it's a, you know, navy blue. It's a, like a, some people will be really specific and other people will be really broad, and nobody's gonna say the exact same thing. That's when you learn it doesn't matter so much what you say. It matters what the other person hears. And how do I restate it if they're not hearing what I'm saying so that they understand what I'm trying to articulate? The nice thing with art is you can sketch it out. You can draw it and say, no, I want it to go together like this. And I want this to be this size and this to be that size. And they need to fit together or whatever. It's nice to hear the what, but sometimes the why helps really cement the reason behind the decision, really helps cement and help that information anchor in some people. Everybody's different. Everybody communicates different.
Speaking to the opposite side of that, what has been one of the most positive and rewarding experiences in your career, whether it be working with a person or on a particular project?
Oh, boy. I think the rewards come in different. You know, sometimes it's the people you work on literally, and are stuck working with for 16 hours a day that make all the difference and make something fantastic out of the experience. But when you're also doing a makeup on them, that's a challenge or something you haven't done before, that's just a whole nother level to it. And those are the ones that become like the most memorable, I think. Dark Man with Liam Neeson, I mean, we're all just in it for whatever the hours were. And we were doing a makeup design that, you know, we didn't know how it would work. And then once we figured it out, it had to have continuity for 20-some days of shooting, which was super challenging. Hairspray was John Travolta and turning him into a woman and de-aging him a little bit and then also making him look heavier and building a whole bodysuit for him. And then watching him and Liam, same thing, watching them work with the limits of the makeup and make something out of that. I mean, for Liam and Darkman, I mean, he's taking breakfast muffins and mashing them flat and making long ribbons so he can eat through the teeth. And he's like, oh, it's just, it is what it is. And it's like, that's the person you want to be stuck with, who's going to figure out how to problem solve and not make an issue out of stuff. And John Travolta was like the same thing. There was never a complaint. There was the same attention to detail and sitting straight in the chair so that the neck is placed accurately and watching the mirror while it's going on and offering his two cents if he's seeing something different, because there's a person on each side doing the glue down, doing the application of the whole thing, just being a vested part of the process the whole way through, and then watching him on set be in charge of the character and how it's used and have a say and how gracious he was with people and how articulate to get things pushed up to the level of quality that it could be all the time, and knowing his own limits at the same time, and making sure that everything was always the best, and having him be that way from day one all the way through 3 months.
That's so nice.
And be the same was just like inspiring. And it's like, this is how I want to be as a person too. He was so articulate and so clear in speaking with someone, and he was so never judgmental or positive. It was just like, he was very inspiring. Mm-hmm. And to do a makeup on him and have that challenge of making it look real and feminine and smooth and last all day and go through dancing and work with wardrobe, that a party dress that weighs 50 pounds, and how do we make that stay and not pull on things? There was always some sort of challenge you weren't expecting. And that experience, I just feel, was like very rewarding on multiple levels as well. So it really comes down to the people.
Yeah.
Quite more often than anything else. And all the Jackass stuff is just like, the challenge is, are we going to get called out? Same with the Sacha Baron Cohen stuff, the disguises and the people that it was being done on. It's like to have Dick Cheney coming for an interview and then have the CIA come and sweep the building, or you're interviewing somebody who they think might become volatile another time, and they have an escape plan and bodyguards in the stairwells and stuff. It's just like, those are very adrenaline-driven experiences where it's like, we're fooling people in front of their face.
That's so nerve-wracking.
In person. And if that doesn't work, then the whole thing doesn't work. So
right.
You've got layers of pressure. But those were just as rewarding for totally different reasons. The nice thing about the Sacha Baron Cohen Who's America show versus Jackass is, I never went to Sasha's shoots feeling I had to wear a cup to protect myself, because I might be pranked while I'm doing my job. And that was one of the things that made all the Jackass stuff really fun too, to be honest, was just everybody and everything was fair game all the time. They were always filming behind the scenes. And if there's something that they could use there, it would get used too. So there was a whole nother level of like awareness and
did they ever prank you?
No, we were really like clear in the beginning. We're like, we're working around your eyes with little pointy brushes, and if something goes wrong, we stab you in the eye and you go to the hospital. We're not shooting today. So
it's a good way to not get pranked.
You know, so let's be really careful here.
Yeah.
But we're not working on their faces all the time, so the rest of the day is like, you know.
On edge.
Yeah, and a lot of them are on edge too, because they know that anything goes.
Anything can happen on Jackass.
Even when we were doing their live cast, they were...
Oh my God, that's so chaotic.
One of the guys, the makeup room has a main mirror in the front and two mirrors on the walls. And we were doing one of the guys, we're going to head cast him. He's like, I know, as soon as you put that stuff on my face, these are two-way mirrors, and Mike Tyson is going to come out of that door, and he's going to punch me. It was like he had this very specific, this is how this whole thing is going down, and this is a setup, and you don't really need my life cast.
And you're like, I swear, I'm just here to do my job,
sir. And it's like, Preston, we're literally doing a life cast of you so we can make an old-age makeup that will fit you and make you look appropriately the right age. And he was convinced that the certain thing was going to go down. Then ironically,
Mike Tyson came out and punched him in the face.
Ken Banks had his phone on him while he was doing we were doing the live casting. And it had that alarm that it's kind of like that klaxon. It's like, really loud. So like Preston's immobilized under all this stuff. And then Ken's phone is like right here next to him. And it goes off like an alarm. And all of a sudden you see his fingers like grab the arm rest and stuff. Aww. Like that. And it's like, dude, no, it's Ken's phone. We're really sorry. There's nothing happening.
Mike right Tyson now. Isn't here to punch you.
Yeah, it's all okay. But like before we did the live cast, we actually took him into the other rooms on the other sides.
To show him
so that he would feel comfortable doing the live cast. Because he needs to be comfortable, you know, he needs to trust us. And then he finally trusts us, and then this alarm goes off. It's like, no, sorry. But it's just a good example of an environment where you're making a movie, but it's also a frat party at the same time.
Every day. Speaking of working on actors and celebrities, who has been, and it's okay if there's multiple, who has been one of the best celebrities to sit still in the makeup chair for you?
To sit still?
Mm-hmm.
I think honestly the best person, one of the best people for sitting still would be Jeff Phillips, who does the Geico Caveman. Because we've done the drill for 20 years.
Right.
He knows the whole thing. If he talks while we're doing this, it gets messed up and we have to redo it and stuff like that. He's fantastic because there's cleaning him up and he's got facial hair and it's getting all that stuff out of the way. And then it's gluing all this stuff down to his skin, and then we've got all these hair pieces that go on top of that, and everything has to have an exact placement, and you end up squaring off in front of him and having him look straight at you and basing the eyebrow placement on it. Has to center above the whites of his eye between his pupil and his nose, and the mustache has to center a certain way, and that was specific to the Geico look that we came up with. And he was so good and so patient about being there and holding still all the time. It was fantastic. Yeah. There's other people that can't hold still to save their lives, so you really appreciate it. Sasha was actually really good when it was like time to do coloring and stuff like that. He'd let us, because he's so tall, he'd let us put the chair down, the recline it, so we could work under here and all that. And he would just kind of zone out, which was pretty great. But I feel like most everybody's been really good as far as like being responsible and respectful, because they know that it's ultimately going to impact how they look and how fast the makeup gets done.
That's true.
You know,
it's like being a parent. Like the sooner you sit still, the faster this gets done.
I guess honestly the best for like not moving at all would probably be Doug Jones.
Well, he's just a pro.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you have to ask him to move so you can do something, you know. Wow. To check the fit on something. He's so good at being just submitting to the process and being a statue, just being there for it until it's done. He's probably the best, I would say.
Aw, shout out Doug. We love you.
Yes, we do.
We do. Huggles. Huggles and happy holidays, Doug.
Okay, so you're in your late 20s.
Ew. Yes.
Who would you consider your favorite director?
Okay.
And why?
That's hard. So I didn't get into filmmaking until later in high school. So it's not like, you know, I grew up knowing directors and filmmakers, but I know what I liked and didn't like of movies. I think Guillermo del Toro is awesome, mainly because he directs in the horror and fantasy genre, which is my favorite genres, and also seems to really know how to direct practical effects and work with those people and actors really well in a way that's effective. I also love the way, whether it's himself or collaborating with his production designers and composers, but his use of color is freaking amazing. The first time I watched Shape of Water, I cried.
Oh.
Just because their use of color was so amazing and made me like lose my mind when she like first has sex with the fish, Doug, and she wears red shoes for the first time.
Oh,
Like it's just a great way to symbolize something that is showing and like not telling.
Oh, that's cool.
That I really appreciate. And then I actually, speaking of film school, I had not seen Twin Peaks, the TV show. But then my boyfriend at the time was really into the show and got me into watching it. And I love Twin Peaks. I think David Lynch is a total weirdo in the best way. I would be lying if I said I understood that man. I think the way he experiments with stuff is really inspiring and shows you things that you wouldn't necessarily think to do.
Yeah.
And then as far as like her stuff really is interesting, but also she inspires me as a person, is Anna Lily Amanpour.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Just because she's also a weirdo and doesn't care and doesn't like filter that part of herself. And
she marches
really,
to her own.
She really goes for it. And that's really cool to see, especially as a woman, because a lot of the times I feel like maybe we are censoring ourselves in some ways because we're in the rooms with a lot of men. And I don't feel like she does that. I don't feel like she compromises. Whether you like her work or you don't like her work, it's just inspiring as an artist.
That's cool. What's your favorite Christmas movie?
Die Hard. My sister's favorite Christmas movie is Die Hard. I think mine is The Santa Claus.
Yeah?
Yeah, with Tim Allen. And everybody thinks that Bernard is like a really hot, sexy elf. Like Bernard could get it. So, and I'm not saying that like I don't agree with that. You know what I'm saying? Like, but it's just very sweet. Like the little kid, Charlie, is so adorable. Also, for some reason, he reminds me of my older brother when he was little and had a bowl cut.
That's funny.
And so, and it's just magical, like believing in Santa.
Yeah, okay.
What about you? What's your favorite Christmas movie?
Krampus.
Really?
No.
Oh.
I actually do really like Krampus, though, just because it twists everything on its head, and it's just the lighting and everything is so interesting. I don't know that I have a favorite Christmas movie, to be honest. I mean...
Gremlins.
It qualifies. There's a lot of films that qualify. I mean, Elf is just... I feel like Elf is the one you could watch over and over again and not get tired of for whatever reason. So I think that's probably the most successful of all of them. It's the most engaging. But even like A Christmas Story, but it's just like there's a whole personal, like they shot it in Cleveland and we were back there when they were filming it right out of college. And we watched them shut down downtown to shoot the parade and stuff. And it was just, it's just kind of like a piece of, you know, of growing up. But we had nothing to do with it as filmmakers. It was just, you know, we were there. We just happened to be there, which was pretty cool.
Speaking of favorites, well, I guess you could answer if you would also like to share, like, from who you enjoy watching's work of who your favorite director is. But I'd also be curious who maybe one of your favorite directors you've worked with is.
I think there's different directors that I've enjoyed for different reasons, to be honest. I feel like Spike Jonze, for whatever reason, feels like very similar in choices and aesthetics to the way that my brain works. So I really enjoy that. And we kind of speak the same language, for better or worse, which is really cool. But I really enjoyed Kenny Ortega because he came at everything from a very refreshing perspective, which was movement and music. And like we were operating a cat and he looked at us as a dance troupe as opposed to puppeteers working together for a performance. And it was a very like refreshing perspective. I think I've always liked Sam Raimi because he's so articulate and polite as well.
Mm-hmm.
And with a good sense of humor behind all of that. So I feel like we've been fortunate to work with some really quality people. There's a lot more that are equally as good though.
Sure.
You know, but those are the ones that they come to mind sometimes based on like specific experiences or projects. What's one instance in your film career so far that has really made a lasting impression on how you deal with film or deal with people?
Oh God. Well, as I've mentioned, I recently directed my first feature. First of all, I don't think anything can prepare you for directing your first feature other than just doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Other than, like, you can research it, ask as much advice. Nothing prepares you other than going through it. And then once you do it, it's like ripping the Band-Aid off. In that experience, I've realized I was the kid in high school who had good grades and would be assigned a group project, and maybe there were some kids in that group project who didn't necessarily put as much effort in or care about getting an A. And this does not mean grades matter, but then I would take on doing work for them so that I could have the end result that I wanted. And I've learned that in a much bigger capacity, you cannot take that mindset with you.
Like making a movie?
Yes, like making a movie. It just doesn't work. And maybe some people, it sounds odd enough to say, might lose respect for you for doing that because they see you as somebody who will take their lack of effort and rise to it. So it might encourage people actually to slack because they know that you'll be there to pick up the pieces. But in that, ultimately, I feel like directing my first feature is, and maybe this is like weird or mean to say, but I'm just on the other side of this experience, is you don't need to be liked by everybody, but you do need to be respected. It does not matter if your crew or your actors like you at the end of the day, because people are people. People are unpredictable. They have their own personal things, their trauma, their experiences, their perspectives. Somebody could literally not like you just because you smiled wrong one day, or you didn't smile, or literally anything. Mm-hmm. You're there to get a job done. And I've been on films where I've experienced a director yell when he shouldn't have.
Right.
And I strive really hard to not be that, but I think I actually strived too hard. Putting your foot down does not make you mean, and does not mean that people won't like you. The people that are meant for you will stick around and see that and appreciate it.
You're the captain of the ship, and if somebody doesn't step up, the whole thing could
crash. And that doesn't mean that you have to step up for them. That's their job, and they should do that. It goes back to like you learning how to run an SFX shop. Like, conflict is hard and scary sometimes, but it also, when you're a leader of a ship, it comes with it, mm-hmm. and everybody's going to learn how to navigate it on their own. And I'm not saying what I just said is necessarily right, but that was my experience.
I think that's an important takeaway too, is everything is based on your own perspectives and your own experience, and your decisions sometimes will be based on your experience to date, and maybe you don't have enough experience to make that decision accurately. So there's always a lot of factors in play, but if you, like you said, find your people in that experience, and you have others that you respect that you can use as a sounding board, they can help you make a more educated decision ultimately.
Yes.
I think another takeaway too is like, people will tell you they can do anything.
Yes.
Because they want a job, and sometimes they can't do it. And how do you find that out? I mean, the best way is to go to the referrals on their resume and ask very specific questions if you have specific requirements these people need to do, whether it's a stunt or a specific function or a artistic skill. Do they have any legitimate previous experience in that?
And I would go further and say, don't even ask just one person for a referral these days. Ask for three. You talk to three people. That's what I'm going to do from now on for a majority of things. You need to really vet people, or else it could really bite you in the butt later on.
Yeah, you don't have to think about them while you're filming, because you don't have the time.
You don't have the time, and Lord knows I didn't, girl. What do you think directors need to know to best help the SFX team when they are directing heavy practical effects films?
What do I think the directors need to know? The directors need to know actually what they really want.
Shocking.
If they can't articulate it, they could share clips from other movies and say, I like this piece of that, or I like this piece of that, or I hate this from this film, don't do this. Mm. Anything that helps put up guardrails to help you get to their vision is ideal. And a lot of directors come in a little wishy-washy because they can't visualize. But if they can go online and pull stills or pull clips or scenes or whatever, I feel like the more they do that, it helps them cement what they want actually. I think stuff like that's really good.
Shameless plug that is not sponsored. I literally went to film school and I was not aware of this website. Shot Deck is a website that you can have access to so many stills of movies for like $8 a month. And they have details on every still of like the camera it was shot on, the color.
That's really cool.
Aspect ratio. Yeah. And it's a really great way to articulate things. If you don't have access to storyboards and you can't draw for shit, stick figures do work, first of all.
Yeah.
Those are ways to express things that you couldn't necessarily say. So
yeah.
So that is a tool that you can use.
And if you're on a show that has some time, like the Chucky TV show, we asked for every scene that Chucky had specific action, like more dynamic action, to be storyboarded. So we knew what angle shots would be filmed from. So we knew where to hide puppeteers and rods and cables and everything else. And we could rehearse so we're not rehearsing on set and wasting people's time. So the storyboard was great because it helped the director refine what was written on the page into something visual, gave them like something to start with that was tangible, gave us something to rehearse and film and share with the rest of the crew, like the DP and everyone else, so that they could go, oh, there's three puppeteers here, we can't put a light there. And it just streamlined the entire process. And Sam Raimi used to do storyboards that were the most basic of stick figures, but we all knew what was in his head. He's like, this angle is going to turn this way and this face is going to zoom in this close. And I mean, it was all the technical stuff was there. And we really knew what to expect happening on camera. And a lot of times we're not at a monitor where we can see stuff. So the storyboards are just invaluable for everybody.
Okay, last question. Or do you think you answered that? And what is something you wish everyone knew more in regards to SFX?
I think I kind of spoke about a lot of it, but I think that there are a lot of producers that have seen like the show Face Off and think everything takes 10 minutes or 2 days to do, or there's a mold in the back and you need an old age makeup. We'll go grab this mold and we'll spray some magic skin in it and peel it out and we'll do a makeup test tomorrow. It's like just a real world awareness of
time,
of what's involved. Yeah, just an awareness of the tangible reality of things.
Yeah. Do you think in terms of the Oscars, special effects makeup should have its own category separate from makeup itself, because beauty makeup and SFX are so different?
They're so different. I mean, people have done such amazing work
that
like
hasn't
highlight
gotten
and
noticed.
Shadow and I mean, like Dallas Buyers Club is all like genuine contouring and shadowing and you know, making people look healthy, unhealthy, and it's so different than full body prosthetic on somebody. It's a different skill set, but they're labeled the same thing because they're on people. I think there could be different categories for that. Yeah.
Yeah, because stunts doesn't even have a freaking category still.
Yeah.
And those people like literally risk their own lives.
Yeah, and do amazing things. And there are camera people that do stunts
so
that are like on skateboards or roller skates with a camera skating around somebody who's on a moped or whatever backwards into traffic and
crazy.
Yeah, and it's just like there's a lot of skill sets that aren't really acknowledged.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's a lot of really creative people out there.
And there's more conversations happening about it now, which is good.
Yeah.
I have a holiday present for our viewers here.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So if you are listening to this, I encourage you to go to our YouTube channel. I just changed the name from my own name to our podcast name, Flesh and Blood and Bone. And for the holiday season, I don't know why I don't have the original Child's Play, but I have Child's Play 2, Child's Play 3, Bride of Chucky, Seed of Chucky, Curse of Chucky, Cult of Chucky, all in the 4K Ultra HD Plus Blu-ray, new condition, never been opened, DVDs, and also my documentary, Living with Chucky, the Collector's Edition. We are going to gift this to one of you. To enter, please go to our YouTube channel, subscribe, like, and comment. What I will do is I will put all the usernames who are subscribed and have commented into like a random generator thing.
Commenting to this particular episode?
Yes, come to this particular episode on our YouTube channel, and then I'll put all the usernames that have commented in a like random generator, and I will pick somebody to receive this as a holiday present.
And one person gets all of those.
And they get all of them.
Wow.
Yes. Somebody from Universal who was trying to help me when I was dealing with my documentary and licensing gifted 2 sets of these to me.
That was nice of them.
Yes. Very nice. And I am very grateful, but I don't need two whole sets of 4K Blu-rays, especially from this franchise, because I own so many things from this franchise. So I figured they should have a better home, and horror fans are absolutely big collectors. So somebody should have this. Otherwise, it's just going to sit on a shelf in my room.
Well, you should sign the documentary.
That is actually why I have a silver Sharpie handy dandy.
There you go.
Right here. And my dad and I are going to sign my documentary DVD right now for you. So I'm going to sign right here. And then you go. The only thing I ask is if you're going to submit, please figure out a way for me to get in contact with you. I'll reach out through DMs, via Instagram, email, things like that. Just be sure there's a way for me to get in contact with you so that I can ask for an address to send these to. And the deadline for entry will be, should I make it Christmas or New Year's?
Maybe you can make it Christmas and then New Year's you could announce.
Oh, I love that. So be sure to submit by 11:59 p.m. Christmas Day, December 25th. And then by New Year's the 31st, I will announce on my Instagram, or if I have time to film something here on YouTube, I'll do that as well. And then I will send this to you.
And what's your Instagram?
My Instagram is Kira E. Gardner, G-A-R-D-N-E-R. And
that's how they could also DM you.
Yes, that's also how you could
contact
DM
info.
Me. Yes. Be sure to be on the lookout, because I've done things like this before, but then the winner, like, I had no way to get in touch with them, and then they got mad, and I'm like, but your DMs were open. I don't know what to tell you. So yeah, with that is our gift from us to you. And we hope you have a wonderful holiday season and a happy new year. We're excited to bring more to you next year with the podcast. Yeah. Hoping I figure out how to have guests on here. The only thing holding me up there is I have one camera.
Oh.
And I don't know how to do that with us both being here and a guest, so I would have to rent equipment, which means that I would need some more finances for the podcast in order to do that, in order to rent camera. So if you want to support us, please go to our Shopify, Flesh and Blood and Bone, and we'll eventually have merch up there for the start of the new year for the podcast. But also right now, my Living with Chucky merch is there right now if you'd like to find a way to support us. And it's like, there's stickers for $5 or posters that are signed by both of us for more money than that. So whatever's clever, we just appreciate it either way.
And then we can get people on.
And then we can get people on, because I got people lined up that want to do it, and I'm just trying to figure out the logistics.
This whole year went fast doing this.
Life moves fast when you're getting traumatized. So next year will be even better.
That's right.
That's our mantra, 2025. Let's go, girly.
Just come back in 2025.
And we'll see you then.
Yep.
Bye, everybody. All right.
Bye.